From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Oil company BP has begun to capture at least some of the oil spilling from a blown well in the Gulf of Mexico before it hits the water. Over the weekend, the company successfully inserted a tube that channels oil to a tanker ship. But large amounts continue to flow into the water, and there are increasing concerns about where that oil might be going. Joining us now from Robert, Louisiana, is NPR's Elizabeth Shogren. And Elizabeth, explain first, please, how this tube works.
Well, imagine a stopper, and out of that stopper comes a very skinny, very long straw. And in this case, the straw is about 4 inches in diameter and goes for a whole mile. And the stopper is stuck into the broken riser, which is on the bottom of the ocean. So what they're doing now is they're diverting some of the oil mixture, that's oil and gas and all kinds of other stuff, up into this skinny straw, up to the surface, to a ship. And at that ship, the oil is going into a tank, and the gas, which, and there's a lot of gas in this mixture, that's getting burned off by a flare. And we just talked to some people from BP who were just flying over the area, and they said that they saw the flare going very strongly right now.
Now, a 4-inch tube, Elizabeth, coming, I guess, about a mile up from the ocean floor, how much oil do we know is actually getting diverted up to the surface?
Doug Suttles from BP says they're capturing about 1,000 barrels a day. They hope to increase the amount that they're able to capture to the point where they're able to capture about half of what's spilling out of the well. But they don't really know. Some other people have told me it could be 80% of what's spilling out of the well.
But Elizabeth, it seems that one real unresolved question here is if they don't know how much oil is coming out of the leak in the first place, how can they know what percentage they're capturing up on the surface?
Well, that's a very good question, Melissa. And I think that what you're going to have to believe from BP is how much quantity are they collecting up in the boat. That's something that they can quantify. But nobody seems to know now very precisely how much is coming out of the well. And until they stop it, I don't think anybody's going to be able to tell us precisely how much is coming out.
Elizabeth, there are also concerns now from scientists that the oil underwater could be spreading farther out, moving toward the Florida Keys, toward the Texas coast, possibly beyond the Gulf of Mexico itself. What can you tell us about that?
Well, they're talking about something called the loop current. This is this huge stream of water that runs from not far from where this well is and goes around Florida and towards the Atlantic and eventually into the Gulf Stream. And the question is the oil now reaching that huge current? And professors from the University of South Florida say that their modeling and their research shows that this is happening now. But government officials from NOAA and the Coast Guard this afternoon said that the oil is not yet reaching the loop current, that there's some sheen that's somewhat close to the loop current, but it has not yet gotten into the loop current. Now, if the oil did get into the loop current, that could have some threats for some of the fragile ecosystems along the way, such as the Florida Keys and the mangroves and coral reefs that are there.
Okay. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reporting from Robert, Louisiana. Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Allison Keyes. This is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. And we're talking fashion. From uber skinny men to plus-sized women, the industry is changing. You'll hear from full-figured model Ashley Graham in a minute. She's making waves with a lingerie ad that a couple of TV networks refused to air in its original form. But first, more about the incredible shrinking man. Skinny jeans are all the rage for guys, and apparently bodies that fit into the glove-like get-ups are the next big thing, or really a small thing. A UK-based company will soon debut a new line of male mannequins with a 27-inch waist and a rather, shall we say, gaunt physique. Isn't that too skinny? Let me ask Adam Rappaport, style editor for GQ magazine. He's on the line from his office in Manhattan. Welcome, Adam.
How are you doing?
And I feel like I have to ask now, what is it you're wearing?
I am wearing matchstick fit jeans from Levi's. They're skinny without actually saying skinny jeans.
These jeans could fit on one of those models, huh?
They might be a little loose on one of those mannequins, actually. They're slim without cutting off circulation, I would say.
Rootstein describes their new skinny mannequin collection as Young and Restless redresses the balance of the prevailing male beefcake figure by carving out a far more streamlined, sinuous silhouette to match the edgier attitude of a new generation. Is the new generation really that small, or are they just wearing clothes that are?
I think they're wearing clothes that are slimmer. I think we unfortunately probably have the same waist sizes we've always had. But you know, you've seen for the last several years the silhouette, as they say in the fashion business, becoming a lot slimmer. Fitted suits, slim jeans, skinny ties. If the 80s and 90s were more of that sort of comfortable Armani suit that is kind of crepey and drapey, now it's all skinny, 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 whether you are or not.
I remember guys used to walk around in pants that were twice their size these baggy shirts. Is that a reaction to this?
It's somewhat. Typically in fashion, the pendulum swings. If everyone's wearing big baggy jeans, then the cool kids want to be wearing skinny tight jeans. You know, once everyone is doing something, the elite want to be doing the opposite. So it swings that way. But what's interesting is how long it takes for the general public to kind of catch on. You know, you were seeing very skinny suits and models that basically look like these mannequins, these very wafy, thin teenage boy mannequins on the runway when Christian Dior's men's line was showing about 7-8 years ago when Eddie Sliman was a designer. And he got a lot of flack at the time for basically bringing out models that were teenage boys with these frail bodies, no hair on their chest, no muscles. And, you know, like I said, that was 7 years ago probably. And now it's kind of catching up more to these big sort of chain stores like Topman and H&M and Uniqlo.
Isn't that a little creepy? I mean, if you're
30... It is creepy. And especially if you see it as you're sitting there at the fashion shows, you're like, wow, that kid's like 16 years old and hasn't really been eating a lot and certainly hasn't seen the sun in a couple of months. But, you know, like I said, I think the label, they want to kind of suggest an extreme and then you kind of adapt to part of that extreme. I don't think people are expecting people to be actually this skinny necessarily or this young, because if we're not that young.
But if you're a 35-year-old guy and you're looking at wafy guy, are you thinking, okay, I've got to eat a pea a day so that I can fit into those jeans? I think I read somewhere that the largest size some of the newer jeans are coming in is a 33-inch waist for a grown man, really?
Yeah. And not too many grown men I know. Listen, I think the average grown man is smart enough to know what he can and can't get away with. And also, yeah, if you have a wife or a girlfriend and you come home with really, really skinny jeans on, she's going to take one look at you and probably send you home. Now, that said, there is a happy medium. You can wear jeans that are straight leg or slim fit without being super skinny tight like you're in Metallica or something. You can wear suits that actually fit you. And the problem that American men have had for many years is that they're wearing their suits a size or two too big. The shoulders are kind of hanging off. Their pants are too slouchy. They've got the pleated pants that they could fit, you know, two of themselves in. So it's like, all right, you don't need to go to extreme. You know, you're not 17 years old. You know, if you're a 40-year-old guy, that doesn't mean you can't wear jeans that fit well. You can wear a suit that fits well. So it's like, yeah, look at the extreme, acknowledge that it's an extreme, and then kind of approach it without necessarily going all the way.
Really briefly, though, I think I've been reading that male eating disorders are on the rise. Is there any connection there, do you think?
You know, as a style editor at GQ, I'm not really qualified to speak on that. I have no idea, and I don't know if that's you're talking teenage boys or if you're talking grown men. But as I said, to suggest that male vanity is something that's crept up in the 2000s is crazy. You know, you look at Saturday Night Fever with John Travolta and the tight suits and the hair dryers. You look at Cary Grant in the 1950s. Men have always been vain. And whether we're wearing tight bell-bottom jeans or, you know, greasing up our hair in James Dean era, to suggest that all of a sudden now we're concerned with our appearance is pretty naive.
That is Adam Rappaport wearing his matchstick jeans, style editor for GQ magazine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And now we turn to a form of radiation that has generated far more concern. The doses from X-ray machines that help doctors diagnose illness. NPR's Scott Hensley reports that the government, manufacturers, and doctors are taking a closer look.
When several stroke patients at a Los Angeles hospital started losing their hair and complaining of reddened skin, doctors looked at the patients' brain scans as a possible culprit. What they found was that the imaging machines were giving the patients too much radiation. This extreme example launched an investigation, but scientists are concerned about radiation damage that builds up over a lifetime from routine tests, too, particularly when it comes to CT scanners, which take 3D pictures inside the body. Simon Choi, a radiation and health expert at the Food and Drug Administration, explains the concern.
Some publications have said even approximately 20,000 future cancers could be related to CT scans performed in the U.S.,
To reduce those risks, the agency is urging doctors to make sure each CT scan they order is really needed. The agency wants patients to talk to their doctors about alternatives.
Patient could ask, what is the justification for this procedure? Are there other options for me?
Other choices that don't expose patients to x-rays include ultrasound and magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI. The FDA also supports safeguards for scanners to alert technicians when radiation doses are too high. The changes are in the works for new CT scanners, and manufacturers are also working to retrofit existing machines. CT scans provide valuable information to doctors, and the agency isn't suggesting that patients forego necessary scans. But even makers of the machines are now supporting a message of moderation. Dave Fisher heads a trade group for scanner makers.
The last thing we want as manufacturers is individuals receiving scans they don't need.
The companies say they are working with the FDA to minimize radiation exposure. Scott Hensley, NPR News, Washington.
To see how much radiation you might be exposed to, check out our website at npr.org. First, they stopped the unstoppable LeBron James. Yesterday, they beat the scorching hot Orlando Magic. And suddenly, the Boston Celtics in the NBA playoffs aren't looking as old and washed up as they did at times during this year's regular season. The Celtics' 92-88 win over Orlando Sunday kicked off the best-of-seven series in the Eastern Conference Finals. Joining us is NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Why don't we begin with those suddenly frisky Boston Celtics? What's going on with them?
Well, I don't know if there's a fountain of youth, but I think what has happened is good health after a bunch of injuries during the regular season, and they're gelling at the right time. A good veteran team like Boston gets bored, frankly, during the long regular season. They get excited for the playoffs, and it seems to be happening here. Celtics coach Doc Rivers said yesterday, "I honestly say we lost ourselves. I think we've found ourselves again." And another thing, beware aging championship players, especially those who've decided they're not done quite yet. It appears to be the case with the Celtics' old-timers. Now, that's old-timers in NBA terms. Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, and Ray Allen are approaching their mid-30s. And it also helps to have a youngster, Rajon Rondo, their 24-year-old point guard, who's driving that team and playing the most exciting basketball of anyone left in the playoffs. So the Celtics were champions just two seasons ago. It appears they're intent on making another run.
And in the Western Conference Finals, the defending NBA champion Los Angeles Lakers looked very strong in their previous series against a tough Utah Jazz team. Shouldn't LA be a heavy favorite against Phoenix?
Don't think so. I mean, the Lakers are favored. They're a big team with seven-footers Pau Gasol and Andrew Bynum, and they have this size advantage over Phoenix, and that gives them an advantage in the slow-paced half-court game. So Phoenix wants to speed things up by running as much as possible, pushing the ball up the court. They've been famous for doing that in recent years. This is a different Phoenix team, though. The Suns have been out-rebounding opponents in the playoffs. They just beat a very good San Antonio team 4-0 in the last round of the playoffs. Phoenix's point guard, Steve Nash, at 36, he's still a wizard with the ball in his hands. He's played more playoff games than anyone in NBA history without getting to the finals. This could be his best chance.
And Tom, finally, there's a notable absence in this NBA Final Four. Cleveland had the best one-loss record in the regular season and the league's most talented player, LeBron James, but the Cavaliers and James flamed out last week against Boston. It might have been the end of his career in Cleveland because James is now a free agent this summer. What's the latest on that?
Well, speculation continues on where he might sign after 7 years in Cleveland. If he goes elsewhere, the front runners appear to be Chicago, New Jersey, New York. But, you know, there's definitely a different feel to the LeBron sweepstakes, as they're called this summer. After the debacle last week, Boston was the better team in that playoff series, and it proved again that one player can't win a title by himself. And now the talk is less wherever LeBron goes, that team will be an instant favorite to win the title, and more LeBron will obviously make any team better, but to win a championship, he still needs another one, maybe two star-quality players to help.
Tom, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman. The rise of China's economy is offering other countries, other governments, an alternative to the free market system. It could be called state-controlled capitalism. And if that sounds something like a contradiction in terms, Ian Bremmer is here to explain it. His new book is The End of the Free Market. In it, he writes that the rise of state capitalism poses a serious challenge to U.S. companies. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Renee.
Let's begin with your definition of state capitalism.
Well, state capitalism is when the state is the principal actor and judge in the economy and uses the markets for ultimately political gains. Where in a market economy, multinational corporations are the principal economic actors.
Let's get some examples of the tension between free market corporations and their state-controlled competitors. One pretty startling statistic you have is that the world's oil production is controlled by state-owned oil companies, 75% controlled.
That's right. And of course, that wasn't always the case. In fact, an easy way to think about this is in the days before national oil corporations, if you were a big oil company, you could go up to a dictator, sign a deal, you'd give them some cash, and you'd stick a straw in the ground. Suddenly, there was a rise of state oil corporations when these dictators realized they had their own straws. And if you were an international energy company, you were out of the straw business. That's not just happening in oil. That's happening across the board.
We're now hearing more about the Chinese car industry, which is state-owned.
That's right. No, you look at aviation, too, and you ask me if Airbus or Boeing is going to have a business selling aircraft in China once they actually get up to speed technologically in building their airplanes. It's coming a lot faster than people think. I think the answer is clearly no. And there are many, many multinational corporations based in the West that thought that they were going to be able to do great business. And suddenly they're going to find that they have real competitors on the ground in the world's second largest and fastest growing economy. But it's not a fair playing field. There is no rule of law. And they're going to get Googled out. They're going to have the same problems that our friends with the world's largest search engine have just had.
You write in a government-controlled capitalistic system, commercial decisions are often left to political bureaucrats and distorted by political goals. What would be a good example of that?
A great example of that would be what you see in Venezuela, where President Hugo Chavez has used their oil company to fund everything from the creation of apartments to agricultural policy. And as a consequence, they haven't actually reinvested at all, which means that Venezuela runs a deficit if oil is under $85 a barrel. They have systematically destroyed their economy. Any multinational corporation would be producing much more oil. They'd have more money to tax. But the inefficiencies of the state are legion.
Do you really, though, envision at any point the end of the free market system?
We are no longer in a global free market economy. The United States is still a free market. Europe is still a free market. Japan is still a free market. But the world's second largest economy and fastest growing out of the global recession is not. And now there are two systems out there. There's a free market system, largely in the developed world. There is a state capitalist system in China, in Russia, in the Persian Gulf. The systems are ultimately mutually incompatible. When your principal actors are multinational corporations in the private sector, and they rely for their growth on unfettered access to global markets, and state capitalist systems don't do that, you're going to have a problem. And we are just at the beginning of that problem.
Well, in the end, who do you see winning? I mean, towards the end of the book, you write, free markets will probably outlast state capitalism.
I ultimately think that's true. The United States has a bigger economy, puts more money into research and development. The educational institutions are stronger. But the United States, Japan, and Europe are not going to be getting their act together globally tomorrow. We know what the unemployment numbers are. We know what the deficit situation is. We're digging ourselves out of a hole. And so as a consequence, over the next 5 to 10 years, the fight is going to get much more obvious.
Thank you very much for joining us.
No, my pleasure, Renee.
Ian Bremmer is the president of the Eurasia Group, a political risk research and consulting firm. His new book is The End of the Free Market: Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations?